Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This week, it's the college admission process. The process of choosing where to apply and where to attend may be an overwhelming part of life for the student and parents. Edward B. Fisk, our guest today, was the education editor at the New York Times for 17 years and is the author of The Fisk Guide to Colleges, which is one of several books he has written to demystify the college application process, as well as to provide strategies to choose where and how to apply for a course of higher education at both public and private colleges and universities. I spoke with Edward B. Fisk from his home in North Carolina and asked him to begin by discussing topics to consider when beginning the college admission application process.
Well, I think the most important thing, Barry, is to find the right match for you, the right fit, as it were. Picking a college is a bit like getting married. It's a question of finding the right match. And you can't really say this is a better person than this, who's a better person than that. You can't really rank people. You have to say, well, this is the kind of person that I would be a good match with. And it's the same thing with colleges. And that's why it's so silly to rank colleges and say this is number 17 and this is number 24 and so forth. You need to find a place where you as an individual are going to grow academically, socially, spiritually, and in just about every other way.
How do you find them out when there's so many and they're so far away? If you're looking for a marriage partner, you size them up, you hang out with them for a while.
Well, one of the things that we try to do in the Fisk Guide to Colleges is to describe the personality and the character of the various institutions, colleges and universities. And then you have to decide, well, does that sound like a place that would be good for me or not? We do have in the beginning of the book what we call the Sizing Yourself Up Survey. And it's a series of open-ended questions. They're not right or wrong, but it's a question designed to help you sort of decide what might be a good place for you. For example, if you say yes to questions like, I like to speak up in class, or I like to do lots of activities rather than have to specialize in one thing, or I like the support of a community, then maybe you should be looking towards smaller institutions. On the other hand, if you say, I can learn well by listening to lectures, I want to specialize in one or two activities, I like times when I can just be myself, then maybe you should think about a larger institution. And it's not a question of right or wrong. It's just a question of personal style and taste. And so if you do a little self-reflection and look at a number of schools, you know, look at different types of schools, especially during that summer trip between the junior and senior year, then you can begin to identify a place that's going to be good for you.
Well, when a person is looking at the schools, what beyond going on the tour and looking at the dorms should happen while they're visiting the campus?
An important thing to do is to look around at the students. And this is the kind of thing which you can get really great insights into if you spend a night on the campus. You know, spend a night in a dorm. And look around and say, who are the people? Who are these people? Do they look like my kind of person? When you're going to spend 4 years in a relatively small community with these people, some of them are going to be your lifelong friends. And so it's important to say, gee, you know, do they look like the kind of people that I'm going to be comfortable with? So just look around at the students. Another thing is to spin off from the guided tour. Go into the cafeteria or the coffee house or whatever there is, and look around and see who's sitting with whom. Do you see faculty and students together? That's a really positive sign. How do the race relations seem to be on campus? And a really good question to ask to your tour guide, but anybody else that you meet, is who's going to teach me next year? I mean, there are plenty of places where you never see a full professor until you declare a major. But what you want to know is not just what the faculty-student ratio is or the average class size. You can say, hey, I'm going to be a freshman next year. Who's going to be teaching me? Am I going to have real professors? Or are they going to be all teaching assistants?
One of the things that I looked for when I was taking my daughters to colleges to go through this process is for a smile on the face of everyone we saw. Were they happy to be there? And on some schools, we just walked away because there were a lot of cigarette butts on the ground and a lot of sad-looking expressions.
Yeah, well, that's getting at exactly the kind of thing I was talking about. Look for the climate, look for the personality of the place. One of the dangers, the editorial risk that I was facing when I first did the Fisk Guide to Colleges, which was now a little over 20 years ago, was that once you'd written about the 17th small liberal arts college in Ohio where the faculty often invited the students home for dinner, they would all sound alike. Yeah, where every big state university would sound alike. And it turned out not to be true. Colleges have very distinct personalities and characters, just like the students who go to them. And so that was a happy surprise because it made the book a lot more interesting to read.
When you put the book together, how are you able to discern those differences?
The main way in which we gather information is through questionnaires to students who've been at the place for a couple of years. They just told us. It was remarkable how few questionnaires it took. I mean, I'm talking 5 or 6, 7 questionnaires where you began to get a feel for what this place was like. And it was who the students were, what's the academic climate like? You know, are students supportive of each other? Are they very competitive, and are they sabotaging each other's chemistry experiments? How accessible are faculty members? This varies all over the map. And these are the kind of questions that are really important when a student or a family is making a decision like this. And I'm not sure I know how to answer your question. The students just told us. And as I said, once you'd read just a relatively small number of questionnaires, you began to get a sense of why this place was different from the school down the road. And over the last 20 years, of course, we've really nailed the character of these institutions. And their basic personalities don't change from year to year. I mean, we update because they build new buildings and start new programs and so forth.
Once a person has selected 2 or 3 or 4 schools, what's the next step?
Well, it's a really good idea, Barry, to visit them if you can. Now, that's not always possible. You can really get a good insight into a place and whether it's going to be a good fit for you if you spend 24 hours on the campus. As I say, the overnight really helps. Students will kick up their heels around 10 or 10:30 and that's the time to really get a sense of what the place is like.
And beyond that?
Well, you can certainly get a lot of information from schools about very specific things from their websites. There are often sort of chat rooms that the admissions office has now set up, so you can talk to current students. That's a good source of information. And if you have particular interests, either academic, you know, things you might want to major in, or extracurricular activities, that's a way of finding out, say, do they have a good radio station, or what's the chance for an okay but not great athlete to play varsity sports as a walk-on. These kinds of questions. There are lots more resources on the Internet for finding out this sort of thing.
How about money? How does a person go after the financial support that might be a prerequisite for them to attend a school?
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that's, of course, important to a growing number of people. I suggest that when the student is on the tour, parents might go have a chat with the financial aid people, because most financial aid comes from the colleges themselves. Either they administer it or it comes out of their own funds. The financial aid people really all know an awful lot about this, and they're used to dealing with the same kinds of questions you're asking. And they can be a real good source of information. It may be that the school has particular kinds of payment plans that would be suited to you. But the first thing to do is to go and talk to several financial aid people on a few campuses. And by then, you'll start hearing repetition and you'll get a good sense of what the score is. One thing to be aware of course, is this huge number of merit scholarships that are out there. It may very well be that you will end up paying less at a private school that has a high published tuition but has lots of financial aid available than you would at a public institution which has a smaller published tuition, but that doesn't have financial aid. So you should really think about the schools you really want to go to and then start looking at the financial consequences. Another thing that I've started thinking a lot more about and talking about more in recent years is as the prices have gone up and as merit scholarships have become more frequent is the possibility of not necessarily going to the most selective school that you can get into. I mean, many people assume, well, I just, you know, shoot for the highest one, the one with the best ranking or whatever, and see what I can get into and then worry about payment. Well, drop your sights a notch in terms of selectivity. And if you are a relatively strong candidate for a particular institution, that means there's a good chance you're going to get a merit scholarship because you're looking really strong in their particular applicant pool. But there are also some academic values of doing this, and that is if you go to a school where you're one of the stronger students, you're going to get the best that that school has to offer, and not just a merit scholarship, but you're going to get access to the best professors. If a speaker comes to campus and the president's rounding up a few students to have lunch with him, you're likely to get included in this. You're going to have research opportunities, summer opportunities, that sort of thing. It's a way of maximizing the value that you get from all the time and money that you're putting into your 4 years of education.
So again, how would a person identify those kinds of schools in comparison to another school where they wouldn't be in that category?
Well, a simple way is to look at where your SATs are in relation to current students. And in the FIS guide, we follow the standard, what's become the standard, it was controversial for a while, method of printing the SAT range for the middle half of the class, which is to say from the 25th to the 75th percentile. If your SAT scores are in that middle range, then the chances are that your scores are not going to be much of a factor in whether you're accepted or not. If your scores are higher than that middle half, then you might want to go to a more selective, maybe perhaps more academically demanding school. On the other hand, as I was just saying, there are reasons that you might pick this one and, as I said, get the best of that school. If your scores are below that middle half, you probably ought to think about a less demanding place.
I'd like to take a moment and say that we're talking with Edward B. Fisk, the author of The Fisk Guide to Colleges, now in its 20th edition. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Ed, I know you have a couple of other books, The College Deadline Planner and Getting Into the Right College. In The Planner, you list several signs of stressed out parents. Can you tell us about those?
The FIS College Deadline Planner is another tool that we have just recently put out. It's a new book, and it's designed to pull together all those deadlines and those nitty-gritty little things that you have to keep in mind and put them in one place. It's organized like a calendar, and it tells you that, like, when you need to register for the SAT so you won't have, or the ACT so you won't have to pay late registration charge. It lists the major competitions, essay competitions and so forth, and what the deadlines are for that. And then along the way, we have, you know, little essays telling you the kinds of things you might be wanting to think about it at whatever time of year it is. So it's a way of making the whole process a little more rational, and so you don't have to go running around the internet or looking through catalogs to find dates. We also try to keep it a little light. I mean, one of the things about college admissions is it can be very stressful for a lot of parents and students, and so we try to offer some tips.
Can you share some of those with us?
Well, for example, we have a list of 10 signs that the college rat race is out of control. Number 10 would be, son ignores State Department travel warning to seek eye-catching community service experience among Kurdish separatists near the Iraq-Turkey border. Yeah. Or, son is distressed to learn that the SAT does not offer extra credit problems. Or, Thanksgiving dinner conversation is devoted to critiquing essay drafts. Or, mom has sudden falling out with best friend after friend's daughter is accepted early at Yale. And I guess our number one sign that the family is losing it is that the message on family home answering machine notes that daughter is a National Merit semifinalist. I was speaking with one woman about this list, and she said, oh my goodness, I think I meet about 8 of them. But it need not be a stressful experience. Seriously, one of the things that I try to tell parents is, think about this as a lesson in adult decision-making. I mean, for most adolescents, the selection of a college is going to be the first time that they've really been making an adult decision on their own. If the parents see this as a learning opportunity, and if they can accept the idea that they're the coach, that they shouldn't be running out onto the floor, that they can prod and help and guide and assist and back up and cry and laugh and so forth, all things that go into it. But it's a way of helping the child learn about how an adult goes about making a decision like this.
Tell us about your book, Getting Into the Right College.
The Fisk Guide to Getting Into the Right College is a book that helps you negotiate the process. It talks about all of the sections describing what you need to know about the interview, the essay, getting recommendations, the importance of SAT and ACT, and that sort of thing. This is not brain surgery. This is not really complicated, but there are a few basic things you need to know about each of the elements of the process. And so in the Fisk Guide to Getting Into the Right Colleges, there's a section on paying the bill, basic information about college finances. And then we have a section called the one-hour college finder. And what it is, a collection of short descriptions of a lot of schools categorized like excellent small colleges or liberal colleges or conservative colleges, Roman Catholic colleges, that sort of thing. So it's a way that you can perhaps spend an hour browsing through this, maybe get the names of a few schools that you might be interested in, and then we would, of course, encourage you to look those schools up in the FISC guides, which would have more comprehensive descriptions. It's a way to get started. It's a way to help you navigate the system.
Well, let's talk about the interview and the student essay. What can you suggest for those two activities?
Well, first of all, interviews are becoming less important. A number of colleges, for example, Stanford, don't give them anymore because they say it's not really fair to let some students have an interview when we can't interview everybody because we just don't have the time. So most interviews are seen as informational. That's a way in which you can ask questions and they can tell you things about the school. And if there are any issues that they want to raise, then it's an interview is a chance to do that. It shouldn't be a real stressful situation. The most important thing may be that to let the kid talk. Actually, the parents shouldn't go into the interview. But if they do find their way in, they should just keep their mouth shut because it's a chance for them to get to know a little bit about the applicant. It's also a chance if there are extenuating circumstances. For example, if somebody, because of the family economics, has had to work and not been able to do much in the way of extracurricular activities, then this is a chance to say this. Or if there's been some health issues in the family that may have made it difficult to keep the academic record up, here's a chance to say this, and then that will go in the file. By and large, interviews don't have a huge impact on the decision.
How about the essay, then?
The essay, when I think about essays, I think, what must it be like to be an admissions officer having to read something like 100 essays a day? So when you're writing your essay, think about the poor person who's got to read it, because they must have had scores of how my trip to Europe changed my life, or how I feel sorry for the homeless. The main thing about an essay is to be a little bit different. It's got to come from the heart, and it ought to tell the admissions office something about you that's not apparent from the transcript or the recommendations. Let them know a little bit about you, and if you come across as a real interesting person and thoughtful, you can write about a really banal topic, but you have to be thoughtful, and they just want something that's got to come and say something about you.
What weight is generally given to an essay?
Well, first of all, a lot of colleges barely read them because they have the larger state universities have so many applications, it's really hard to give consideration to the essay. So it tends to be the smaller institutions where the essays are really important, and they tend to be in the tiebreak kind of categories. On the other hand, it's a chance for you to just stand out, because there are some students have written some very stunning essays. But again, you've got to just look for something inside you. It's almost like a poem, something that will tell, hey, there's some real depth to this person. In a sense, the point about essays is the same one that applies to your extracurricular activities. Colleges don't necessarily want well-rounded people. They want a well-rounded class. They don't want somebody who's engaged in 10 or 12 different extracurricular activities and never become a leader in any of them. So what they're looking for is depth
in the class. So therefore, if you play the trombone and you like to march and you even have poor grades, you're likely to be on the marching band.
That's right. They need trombones every year. They need a goalie for the hockey team. They need cello players. They need artists. What they're trying to do is to create the most interesting community they can, because that's what makes the college an exciting place. And so they want lots of people who are into lots of different things, but people who are into these things at a depth where they'll be able to then contribute to the community as a whole.
So once a student has chosen the college, then comes the question of early admission. What are your comments on that process?
Early admission is becoming an insidious practice, and the rules are set up mainly for the advantage of the colleges. I mean, they're the ones, of course, who are setting up the rules. And the idea is, if you can line up a lot of good students early on, maybe up, say, a third of your class, which is not uncommon these days, some colleges it's over half, then that means you have to send out fewer acceptances in order to get the other half. So you look a lot more selective. That's just part of the image. And it doesn't work to the advantage of the student. If you are, cross your heart, hope to die, dead set on a particular place, you know you really want to go to it, then early decision is fine. You know, go for it. But most high school students aren't ready to make a decision in the fall of the year, which is when you have to fill out your early decision courses. And you're going to be a lot older by the time you're of April of your senior year than you are in September. You're going to have had more experience. You're going to have a better understanding of yourself in many cases. And so the normal procedure ought to be the regular one. The other problem with early decision is, and this is a huge one, and it makes the system also unjust, is that if you accept early decision, you're then at the mercy of what they offer you by way of financial aid package. And they'll say, well, we offer the same amounts to early decision as regular students. Well, maybe, but if you are a competitive student and April comes along and you've got three or four offers of acceptance with varying amounts of financial aid, you can go to the school you really want to go to and say, hey, the school down the road is offering me $4,000 more a year in scholarship. Can you match this? Because I'd really like to go to your school. But if you go early decision, you lose all that leverage.
Are there any advantages to early decision?
From the point of view of the student?
Yes.
Well, you have a much more relaxed senior year. That's the main advantage. You know that you're in. You can go about enjoying yourself more. So there's a lot less stress. But you pay a price for that, because you give up your choices, and you give up your financial aid leverage.
Well, Ed Fisk, author of The Fisk Guide to Colleges, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to give us a recommendation on an interesting book.
I'm going to give you two. I have sort of joined what's becoming a small cult of fans of the number one ladies detective agency. And this is a series of whodunits, but not really whodunits in the Western sense, set in Botswana. It's about the first female private detective in Botswana. And it's actually written by a man, Alexander McCall Smith, who lived in Botswana for quite a bit of time. But I've talked to some of my friends from Botswana, and they say that he really has the culture nailed. And these are mysteries But they're solved in a very African way. It's not just what's the mystery, gather the evidence, who's the culprit, put him in jail. It's ways of working out situations to the best advantage of all parties, and it brings a whole different mentality to the private detective field. And there are now five of them. The first one was the number one ladies detective agency. Then there was Tears of the Giraffe. Another one was, the third was Morality for Beautiful Girls. And there are two more that one of which has just come out. And so it's just a wonderful series of thinking that gets you thinking in very different terms. Can I give another one?
Of course.
The other one is a book by a woman named Samia Sarageldin, Sarageldin. And it's a novel, but it's actually a thinly fictionalized memoir called The Cairo House. And she's a woman who grew up in a politically active family in Cairo. This is a story about her returning to the house where she was born and trying to figure out whether she can recover any sense of the girl that she was. But it's a beautifully written story, and it's also one that says an awful lot about Arab women in modern culture. I think she's one of only a couple of Arab women now currently writing in English. So it's called The Cairo House.
Edward Fisk, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Edward B. Fisk is the author of The Fisk Guide to Colleges and other books related to the college application process. The books that he recommends are the series called The Ladies Number One Detective Agency by Alexander McCall Smith and The Cairo House by Samia Sarageldin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we do appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. And our phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us for the next edition of Radio Curious.